Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams, and now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears along with you live here on a Friday night, September 11th, 2020. 15 and a half minutes past the hour, and you are tuned in for a great live two-hour show tonight. Now, before we get to our guest in hour number one, which I'm really excited about, which I will tell you about in just a moment, I want to let you know that coming up in hour number two tonight, we have a surprise guest who is going to comment on everything going on politically with the Bob Woodward book and President Trump, and also about September 11th, 19 years later. So a surprise guest next hour you won't want to miss. And we'll also leave some time for open phone lines next hour before we go off the air tonight. Now, this hour, we have a real touchstone. We've been since I went to mornings, we've been trying to negotiate a time to have this gentleman on. He has been such a pal to me over the years. Now, this is what I want to mention. I usually don't like to inject myself into the interview, but I'm going to do it here for this reason. I want to tell a story because we're coming up on an anniversary. The date was September 11th, 2011. There was a boxing match between Floyd Mayweather and Victor Ortiz. The bout happened. Mayweather won. After the bout, legendary HBO boxing analyst Larry Merchant goes into the ring to do an interview with Floyd Mayweather. And this interview, for what it's worth, goes off the tracks a little bit, and there's a little altercation toward the end of this interview, in which Mayweather says HBO and Larry Merchant never gave him a fair shake, and Larry Merchant replied by saying, "If I were 50 years younger, I would kick your hindquarters." And he did not say hindquarters, if you remember well. And I know you remember, because it was all over TMZ. It was trending the next day. It was on all the news sites. It was on all the sports sites. Now, why is this important? This is important because Larry had been on the show prior to that. Immediately, I called Larry when I'm watching this, and I get the answering machine. But I had Larry's cell phone number. I knew he obviously was not at home. I called Larry the next day, the Sunday following the Saturday night fight. I got him in the airport, and I'm thinking, he's on TMZ. He's coming back from this fight. He doesn't probably have time to do an interview, but I'll call up and maybe we can set something up for later in the week, because you always want to be quick in journalism. Larry picked up the phone in the airport. He was in the airport. I told him who I was, told him that I wanted to do an interview about this. He sat down in the airport, did an interview. We had it on that night. I was doing a Sunday show at that time, and that was one of the kindest acts in my broadcasting career. And he was with us during the World Series, in which the Chicago Cubs won the World Series, and then the Boston Red Sox, and he's been a regular guest ever since. And we have been so lucky. You probably know him best for his 35 years as the HBO unflappable boxing analyst. What a pleasure it is. And now I'm going to shut up and get out of the way, because you want to hear him, Larry Merchant. Larry, how are you?
Hi, Scott. I promise not to counterpunch you intuitively as I did with Mayweather.
Almost 9 years ago now, Larry. What do you remember about that night?
Well, it was a prize fight with a opponent named Ortiz, who was considered the to follow in the path of Oscar De La Hoya, as a great American, Mexican-American attraction, but he wasn't really that good. And Mayweather, there were a lot of passions that were unleashed coming up to the fight and during the fight. And there was a strange ending to the fight when the referee walked away to check with the timekeeper about something. And the younger Ortiz looked away from Mayweather, and Mayweather clocked him. And as far as the audience was concerned, there was nothing on the back of their tickets that said, you can do that. Maybe the boxing rules say you can do that. But in any event, he knocked Ortiz out while Ortiz was following the referee with his eyes. And when I went into the ring to interview him about the incident and what had happened and what he saw and so forth, he jumped on me. He said that I don't know anything about boxing and HBO should fire your hindquarters. And I intuitively, from somewhere in my long ago life as a football player, I guess, just said to him, if I was 50 years younger, I'd kick your behind.
And of course, as we say, didn't say behind. Did you think when you came out of the ring that night, Larry, that it would be what it became?
Well, when I got out of the ring, I thought this would be no lower than the second paragraph of my obituary. And I went to have lunch with some friends. I had a grandson who was there, who was telling me that I was bumping somebody named Beater, the boy singer, off the charts. And that I was all over the place, and to me it was just a laugh, a smile. I knew that it was unusual what I did. Back home in California, my wife and her friends were debating whether I used the proper grammar when I said, if I was 50 years younger instead of if I were 50 years younger.
Oh, Larry. How angry were you on a scale of 1 to 10 in that moment?
Well, it was a spontaneous eruption. I don't know if you can be angry that quick, because he said it, and then I just popped out with it. And afterwards, I walked out of the ring, and I just said, what just happened to myself? But I sort of knew that there would be a storm coming, and TMZ was following me around with cameras in West Los Angeles, and meeting me at planes, and the head waiters were suddenly bowing and scraping to me. So I knew that it had transcended something.
You know, Larry, when you look at it, it's interesting because it's 9 years later now, and if you search Larry Merchant on Google, that's the picture you get more than any other. That's the video you get more than any other. You were in your 34th year of your 35 years with HBO at that time. Did you think that would be the defining moment, that that's going to be the one people remember?
You know what? I don't think that way. You know, I know what moments were defining for me. I don't know what the world was going to decide. But I pretty much understood, being a news person for 60 years, that this was the kind of thing that transcended a boxing match or any kind of a sporting event. I didn't know how long it would last. I didn't know I'd be here 9 years later talking to you about it. my favorite interview happened to be with a guy named Buster Douglas. But the world decides that, I don't, and I can't control it, and so here I am.
Well, I want to say this, two things about this, and then we'll move on to COVID-19 and everything else going on in the world. Number one, you did me a great solid that day, because the station I was working at the time, the general managers, who rarely ever speak or spoke to me at that particular time, were so shocked that I had you on so quick that it did me really, it was a good day for me to have you on that night, Larry. So quick.
Well, next time I'll try to sign on as your agent.
you might have to do that. And the other thing is, Buster Douglas, I went down to Columbus right before COVID in February on the anniversary of the Mike Tyson fight and interviewed Buster in person. He's doing well. Why is that your defining interview?
Well, of course it was a major and presumably historic event in boxing when Tyson got upset. And the backstory of Buster Douglas, the difficulties he had with his father, who I had once seen fight in Madison Square Garden, his mother having died a few weeks before, and there was a human part of this that needed addressing. But Buster Douglas, knowing these stories and the travails he had been through, was literally speechless for about 20 or 30 seconds after the fight. I was intending to approach the story of his mom's passing later in the interview, but finally, after that long of nothing being said on air, which, as you well know, is like an eternity in television time, and watching him try to pull himself together, and finally he did. He wanted to speak about these things. And the fact that I just stood there for those 20 or 30 seconds and waited, and which allowed people just to watch this prize fighter who had just pulled off this unimaginable upset and the emotions he was going through, to me was a sign of, well, okay, now I'm a professional. That I knew the story is show and tell, and all I had to do was just keep the mic there and show what Buster Douglas was feeling, and then we would try to tell the story.
I was down, as I said, interviewing him back in February. This is the 30th anniversary year of that. When you look back 30 years later now, Larry, was Tyson off his game? Did Buster get lucky? What happened that night?
I think Buster Douglas made it happen. I think he stunned Tyson. And if Tyson wasn't at his best, hadn't trained because he was overconfident, or whatever other distractions he may have had, that's on him. A star prize fighter in the modern era fights two, maybe three times a year. It's his job to be ready, no matter who the opponent is. So, and Buster Douglas went out there, and after two or three rounds, we were saying on air that Tyson was taking more punishment than we had ever seen him before, and Douglas was just outboxing and outpunching him. And then there was the knockdown situations. Then after the fight, Don King and his pals at the WBC trying to overturn a knockout. And my having to go as a witness at a trial-like situation in boxing, so that some judges could decide what the true story was. So it was a gift that came on, kept on giving.
And for those of you out there on YouTube, there is an interview that Larry conducts with, and there was all this controversy, if you remember 30 years, Larry just touched on it there, an interview that Larry conducted on HBO, and I think it was the only time it happened, with Mike Tyson and Buster Douglas on the set after the fight. That's a little bit of a tense interview. It didn't seem all that comfortable for them.
Well, I guess in a way, both of them were in shock. I mean, I recall Buster Douglas trotting to the ring and not walking to the ring as though he was going to the gallows and commenting about it. So he knew something the rest of us didn't, and then he acted it out.
Do you believe, Larry, because it's an interesting thing, in a boxing match, if a tragedy happens like that, you lose your mother, your beloved mother, can that motivate somebody to slay the dragon as Mike Tyson was at that point, the man who had knocked out Larry Holmes?
I think it depends on the person and the character of the person and his feelings and... I mean, he can only the athlete can do that. And in this case, Buster Douglas, having trained the last few weeks, knowing his mother had died, being in Tokyo, it helped to galvanize his forces and focus 1,000% instead of 100% or less, because he hadn't always had that kind of man-eating desire. But it was there on that night, and that's all that matters.
Before we move to COVID anniversary, we talked about the Floyd Mayweather-Ortiz anniversary coming up in 8 days. We've talked about the 30th anniversary of... you'll have to get a cake that day, Larry, or something to celebrate that.
Well, if I could get some people to come over to my house, but not these days.
Well, and yeah, that's unfortunately
I
where we...
I have to celebrate alone.
30th anniversary of Mike Tyson, Buster Douglas this year, but also today is September 11th, 19 years ago today. Where were you? What are your memories of September 11th?
Was it today or was it February 11th?
I believe it was September 11th today. The fight was... when was the fight? September 17th, 2011.
Now, which fight are we talking about?
That would have been, or are you talking about Douglas and Tyson?
Yes, because it happened on my birthday.
Yes, February 1990. Absolutely. So September 11th, where were you when that tragedy hit the world, the Twin Towers?
I was in New York, actually. We had a big fight scheduled that weekend. Bernard Hopkins against Felix Trinidad, a major event. I was in a hotel with my wife. We got a call from the concierge at about 8 or 8:30 in the morning. I don't recall the exact time. Maybe it was 9. To turn on our televisions. And we saw the second plane hit the tower. We followed it a while and then took a walk up to Central Park, where there were a lot of people that seemed in shock, sitting on benches. We saw people walking uptown from Wall Street and who knows where, all seeming in shock. It was personal to all of us. None of us were born at the time, any previous time when somebody had invaded us. So it was a serious time, and from a personal point of view, I had lived in Greenwich Village for a decade, and I didn't like the Twin Towers. They rose and loomed over what had always been this genteel area of shops and ordinary working people and artists, gay communities, not Kansas, or Ohio, I guess. I resented that this monster building was looming over me wherever, whatever street I walked down, it seemed that I couldn't escape. But the next time I came to New York, which was a week or two later, and we were in a flight path that saw the hole in the ground where it once stood, it was like a sock in the stomach.
There was a lot of talk at that time about it had changed us. 19 years later, did it stick?
You know what? I'm not smart enough to know that. I know that the emotion that it generated sent us off to the war in Iraq. I don't think that was a great triumph. And it got us deeper into Middle Eastern politics and warfare. That wasn't a great triumph. I don't know what unseen force it represents in our lives today. I don't know how people remember those things. I mean, I'm old enough to remember World War II, but it had a profound impact on a society, yes.
And here we are in a time that is certainly going to be remembered for a very long time, something the likes of us have never seen before. 102 years since the last pandemic, COVID-19, right in the middle of it here. What have you made of this, Larry?
Well, my wife and I have tried to do the smart, safe thing. We are mostly housebound. We wear masks. I have a daughter and son-in-law and two delicious little grandsons that live nearby, and they pop over once in a while. But it's been a remarkable ongoing event, like a war. And it has become a prism through which we can see a lot of things that we didn't see clearly before it. We've seen how minorities have been more affected by this than others. We've seen how our president has tried to kick the can down the road and let others take the responsibility rather than be a real leader. It's a prism through which we see much. The protest movements in some ways reflected by this invasion of invisible armies. I don't know how it will be perceived 10 or 20 years from now. It's bound to be planted somewhere in our brains or the brains of my grandchildren for a long, long time.
For a man reporter who covered sports for so long, in the beginning, we saw the NCAA cancel March Madness. We saw Major League Baseball get delayed, then play without anybody in the stands. The NFL, we'll see how that goes. Some sporting events aren't taking place at all. What have you made of the way this has affected sports, and have sports handled this right?
Well, there's no precedent for this. Yes, there was a pandemic a century ago, but there wasn't television and all the money that television has poured into sports. So it's a new model. And I think whether some people had to be pushed kicking and screaming or not, by and large, they've been responsible. I'm not sure if you opened the stadium up and let everybody in for free that they would want to fill a stadium and potentially jeopardize their health any more than people would crowd into theaters in New York under these circumstances. But sports is on television. The U.S. Open tennis tournament is coming to a climax. NFL is starting. Baseball is beating a path down toward playoffs. There'll be some college sports. There's a lot of resources involved in the sporting scene that affect a lot of jobs and a lot of lives and a lot of public institutions, private institutions. I hope I'm around long enough to see how we come out of it.
Do you think, and it's all a guess, we all hear the same news, that this will be over spring of next year, or is it going to be with us? Are we going to be wearing masks in September of 2021?
Now, this is an occasion in which if Floyd Mayweather had said to me, "You don't know nothing about pandemics," I'd have to agree with him. I would have patted him on the shoulder. This is way above my pay scale.
I tell you, we're going to move here because we're moving along here. Now, this is interesting, and Larry will have an interesting perspective on this because 2 days ago, Bob Woodward, legendary Watergate journalist, has been interviewing President Trump on the telephone for a new book. And the audio tapes of this were released 2 days ago. Now, we can play these, and we're going to play them right now. It's going to take about 3 minutes. Larry knows Trump from the boxing days. So, and there is a presidential election coming up here in just about 50 days. Sit back, listen to these. They start on February 7th. Now, remember, February 7th is about a month before we really started to cover the pandemic in this country. But here are the Woodward tapes with President Trump. Take a listen, and we'll come back with Larry in about 3 minutes.
And so what was President Xi saying yesterday?
Well, we were talking mostly about the virus, and I think he's going to have it in good shape, but, you know, it's a very tricky situation. It goes through air, Bob. That's always tougher than the touch. You know, the touch, you don't have to touch things, right? But the air, you just breathe the air, and that's how it's passed. And so that's a very tricky one. That's a very delicate one. It's also more deadly than your strenuous flus. You know, people don't realize we lose 25,000, 30,000 people a year here. Who would ever think that, right?
I know.
It's pretty amazing. And then I say, well, is that the same thing?
For,
this is more deadly. This is 5 per, you know, this is 5% versus 1% and less than 1%. You know, so this is deadly stuff. Now it's turning out it's not just old people, Bob, just today and yesterday. Some startling facts came out. It's not just older
yeah, exactly.
young people, to plenty of young people.
So give me a moment of talking to somebody, going through this with Fauci or somebody who kind of it caused a pivot in your mind, because it's clear just from what's in on the public record that you went through a pivot on this to, oh my God, the gravity is almost inexplicable and unexplainable.
Well, I think, Bob, really, to be honest with you...
Sure, I want you to
I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down.
Yes,
Because I don't want to create a panic.
But let me ask you this. I mean, we share one thing in common. We're white, privileged, who my father was a lawyer and a judge in Illinois, and we know what your dad did. And do you have any sense that that privilege has isolated and put you in a cave to a certain extent? Is it put me, and I think lots of white privileged people, in a cave, and that we have to work our way out of it to understand the anger and the pain particularly black people feel in this country? Do you
No, you really drank the Kool-Aid, didn't you? Just listen to you. Wow. No, I don't feel that at all.
Do you think there is systematic or institutional racism in this country?
Well, I think there is everywhere. I think probably less here than most places, or less here than many places.
Okay, but is it here in a way that it has an impact on people's lives?
I think it is, and it's unfortunate, but I think it is.
And those are the tapes from Bob Woodward in the Washington Post. Larry, let's start with the pandemic part of that. What do you make of the president's comments on the pandemic to Bob Woodward?
You know, leadership is leaving. He has said in other places, well, he's supposed to be the cheerleader. Nope, he's supposed to be the coach or the quarterback. He's supposed to get everybody together and give them the truth, okay, and tell them how we're going to beat this, and tell them that they're going to have to wear masks and distance themselves, because this is a proven way of trying to fight this unseen killer. But he sees that as being weakness, that he won't be perceived as being strong, at least in his own eyes. Listen, this is a guy who never does the right thing, who always does what's best for him. And in those moments, he was afraid that somehow it would accrue to him, his responsibility. And so he laid it off to the states and the cities. Whatever the opposite of leadership is what he has done with the biggest challenge of his tenure as president.
With about 50 days until the presidential election, up until this point, there was a prevailing narrative in this country that any president that would have had to deal with this, no matter how you spoke about it, it would have been tough to deal with it because it came out of nowhere.
Correct.
48 hours ago, we now know on February 7th that he was having conversations with the president of China. Is this going to be a problem for him, or will it go under the rug like so many other things, like the Access Hollywood tape?
I don't know. His true believers must be the truest believers ever, because nothing he says or does can shake their loyalty toward him. So there apparently is out there 40% or more of the people who are going to worship at his feet no matter what. There are on the margins, however, people who may get tired of this, may get tired. I've always thought that his inclination to want to be on camera day and night, and quite aside from the fact that of how many lies and exaggerations he routinely spews, would do him in if anything did, because people would just be tired of watching him. People live their lives. They're not into politics all that much, except around election times and so forth. And here is this guy coming at them, fighting his demons, creating his followers from all sorts of places that none of us in civil society would want to be. And that's how he's marched through his life, and he's become the president. We talked about this 3 years ago, about his being the great snake oil salesman out of the tradition of Mark Twain. It was an amazing thing to follow. But when the big moment came along, the moment when leadership was needed, he was ducking for cover. This is the guy who calls our military suckers and losers. Okay? And he wasn't going to be a sucker or a loser. He was just going to dodge responsibility. Well, in plain sight. And here we are.
Larry, as you said, we're not doctors. We don't know. But, and the prevailing narrative, again, is right now there are only two presidents, Obama and Trump. So I want to put it this way. Let's go back to Dwight Eisenhower. If this had happened during Dwight Eisenhower being president, and we now know that there was a strong, a major understanding, Trump totally understood what was going on with the pandemic, what was coming on February 7th. Remember, we did not get it until, I think it was the 10th was the day that things started to shut down, March the 10th. If it had been somebody else, could it have been different?
It depends on who somebody else would be, and Eisenhower would surely be one of the somebody else's. He never lied to us about the costs of invading France and North Africa in the beginning of the end of World War II. And he was a military man who understood that you had to be honest with the troops.
The second part of that tape, with the 7 minutes we have remaining, time always goes so fast, is the underplayed part of this because of the pandemic story, is the systemic racism part of it. What did you make of President Trump's comments to Bob Woodward on that?
Well, he's in full election mode almost all the time. So the only thing he values in minorities is the hope that he can get some of them to support him. And so now he's the best friend of the minorities. I kind of sort of doubt it. And if the vote comes out, I kind of sort of believe that it will be a deadly thing for him.
I was talking to somebody the other day about the upcoming election, and I'm pretty sure that they were not a supporter of President Trump, but they said, I just don't know about Biden. And for whatever people felt about Hillary Clinton, they either really liked her or they really hated her. Biden seems to be, maybe it's because of the pandemic and no rallies or anything, it's a little vanilla. Do you think he can defeat a president who does have people who, as you say, would follow him? Well, if he shot somebody on Fifth Avenue, I think was the line.
If Americans think they need a change, we need a change, it won't matter who the Democratic nominee would be, as far as I could see, unless it was some extremist. And while, you know, Biden may not be the guy you want us leading into battle, I think from a political point of view, he might restore some of the normalcy of an American Democratic leader of a republic. Something that I think we desperately need at this moment, so he might just be the right man at the right time. Whatever he's left with to write after the election, if he is elected. But it seems that the Democrats have come up with their best possible ticket at this moment, and the polls reflect that, and other things reflect that. I was just reading in the newspaper in the last couple of days that fewer parents are naming their kids Donald, their little boys named Donald, than before. I see that as a indicator of some kind.
November 3rd comes very quick. We all had predictions in 2016, and certainly pollsters were wrong. So at this point, I think anybody's guess is as good as anybody else's. If the election were held tomorrow, who would win?
My head says that Biden will win, or conversely, Trump will lose. My gut is scared to death, because I think 4 more years of this hustler would just destroy our institutions. Our institutions of checks and balances in the courts and in the legislature. Our belief in the American story, and that this was just a one-time cancer.
Is that what you just said? Is that kind of the point? In 2016, certainly people were either voting for Hillary or they were voting for Trump. Is this election all about Trump? I either am voting for him because I like him, or I'm voting against him because I don't like him and the Democrats are irrelevant.
I think to a large degree it is. And I think that Biden is a good representative of the center-left in America, and that we need some civility, somebody who maybe can't change the whole dynamic of our social structure, nor should he, but is somebody that the far-right crazies even won't be able to find fault with.
Larry, as I teased earlier, you knew Donald Trump somewhat, not that you were social friends, through the boxing world. Who is he away from the camera?
Well, he's sort of a representative of the very wealthy who don't think that the rules of society apply to them. He makes it up as he goes along. He uses batteries of lawyers and fixers to delay things that matter. And we'll find out if the country that we're living in, whether this is the guy we want to have as president again or not.
Before we part ways, I want to make this known that we talked about the Mayweather line earlier, and the Buster Douglas line that always sticks with me is Larry said during the broadcast when Tyson was knocked out by Douglas, "This makes Cinderella look like a sad story." I don't remember a whole lot of things. Larry came on with us a few days, maybe the next day, after President Trump was elected in 2016, and I'll never forget the line he said. He said, "A New York con man conned America." With all these great lines, Larry, what's the line for America today? Pandemic, election, where are we now?
We're at a moment of truth. A truth of who are we as a people.
Larry, you have been such a pal to me. And I cannot thank you enough. Hope this is over before your big birthday coming up on February 11th next year. And I hope we do many more interviews more often, because I've forgotten what a pleasure it is to talk with you.
Scott, thank you. It's always a pleasure. And I learn as much from you as you hopefully learn from me.
Stay well, Larry. We will talk again, certainly around election time, without doubt.
Thank you, and have a good weekend.
Take care. The legendary Larry Merchant will be back with the surprise guest in 10 minutes.
Interview her there, and she is as smart an announcer as I ever saw. I mean, a designer. She's probably one of the best designers. She just took to that very well. For that one. Then I